Okay, sure. I'll bring it up. Wait here for. Okay.
It's just so I've been what I've been doing so far is that I did a couple of experiments and
Okay.
I have to analyze the results more deeply, but I've been trying to, you know, read more into the documentation of NILFS and, you know, try to understand first how it works to make some, I mean, once I see the results, like make some real assumptions about it, like, instead of just, you know.
Okay, so you have a few slides explaining NILFS.
Yes.
I see. Okay. So do you want to go through these slides or do something else?
So, yeah. I mean, unless Vasily has something to that he wants to talk about first.
So, yeah, just to give a broader picture, Ricardo was able to run the experiments and the scripts and everything. So we met and thought that the first problem to tackle, the first thing that requires an explanation or at least some theory in the paper, is why performance of the NILFS remains constant no matter what is the latency of the underlying device. So this is the first issue that Ricardo is trying to solve, and one of the things that makes sense is, of course, trying to understand how NILFS works internally at the high level at least to make some conclusions. So I think in this presentation, he probably did some investigation, and he's going to present it to us, right?
Yes.
So let me ask you, Ricardo, were you able to reproduce the results that Vasily had?
Well, I don't have the exact data that Vasily has right now, but I mean, if I get the data, I can compare.
Well, the reason I'm asking is before we go into this NILFS completely and try to understand why performance may be the way it is, it would be good to actually verify that the performance problems exist
for
in your system as well, so that you can actually do a little bit more.
Okay. Yes.
Wasn't that what we decided to reproduce what he had?
Yes. I mean, and I repeated the experiments, but then I didn't have enough time to look at it.
Okay. So you have done the experiments.
Yes. Yes. I run the experiments, but I...
So you have all the data that Vasily showed last time, except that you don't have it in graph form.
Right.
You have them, you don't
so
have
I generated graphs. Some of it. And
so it would be good if you can, you know, when you are able to create the graphs, to write us an email saying that either confirming what Vasily found with his machine,
okay,
with his system.
So should I repeat all the experiments?
No, you already done it.
Like, yeah, but should I run for all the points? Because I run like a few only.
So yeah, so I think there is a misunderstanding. I don't think Ricardo ran all of the data points. He just tried a few just to see if the system works. And then for this specific issue, I don't think Ricardo needs to run all of the experiments. It takes a lot of time just to reproduce everything. The only thing that, you know, the first step to reproduce NILFS behavior for one workload for the web server, that would actually remain constant. That would actually does not change with the latency of the device. So this definitely requires confirmation on your machine, 100%.
So I haven't generated the graphs yet, but I have the data for a few of them.
But I think you're looking at just one to begin with, just one plot, which is NILFS.
Yes.
For that workload under varying latencies.
Exactly.
But that's what you're trying to investigate, right?
Yes. Now. What I'm trying to understand is why NILFS have that behavior.
On Vasily's system.
And Vasily's system, and I'm checking if it repeats also on my system as well.
Okay.
And then, but I thought that at least for me, the first part before making some analysis of or anything that's happening is understand the system, how this file system works.
That makes complete sense, to understand how the file system works.
So,
but before that, I think you need to confirm that you see the same behavior on your system as well.
Okay.
For NILFS.
Okay.
And in the background, I mean, while you're doing all this investigation, it might make sense to collect the same data that Vasily collected. And you're not waiting for that data.
Okay.
It's just being collected. You make use of the machine resources that are available to you.
Okay. I can run it. I mean, I can leave it running for a day and just get out.
We get the NilFS first.
Okay, sounds good.
Yeah, and I mean, one correction that I would like to add here is that so you will get the line for NilFS. In fact, you just need even 2 points for the beginning. Let's say you take 1 millisecond latency and 10 millisecond latency, right? And if the performance is approximately the same, that's already the indication that you are confirming the result that I see on my machine, right?
Yeah.
Because 10 times different latency would cause a significant difference in the other case. That's at least what you expect. So just 2 points is enough to start the analysis. So that's one thing. And second is that be careful when you run other file system or other workloads, because if I understand correctly, you only have one machine.
Mm-hmm.
And then the analysis of these two cases might require you rerunning this same experiment, NilFS, in these 2 points several times with collecting more information, adding some instrumentation maybe, or stuff like that.
Okay.
So it means that if you occupy a machine for 3 days running other file systems, you won't be able to perform the analysis. And I believe that performing the analysis has a higher priority, because we can get the results on my machines, we already have them, right? But explaining them, we don't have that part yet.
Okay. Yeah, sounds. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, that's a good point, Vasily.
Makes sense.
Okay.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about NilFS. I'm on slide number 2. Can you see my presentation, Vasily? I share it with you too.
Yeah, I can see it. I'm on slide 2, thanks.
Okay, awesome. So, so the first thing is like, what's the most, so NilFS is a log structure file system, and the main attribute that, or the main feature that it has is that it does continuous snapshots. So since NilFS is a log structure file system, it does writes in place, and it has a couple of exceptions. One is the super block, and one is for segment summaries, which I'll get into later on. So the data is divided into segments, and these segments are of default size of 8 megabytes, and they store different kinds of data. They can hold actual data, the data indexes, inodes. They contain both data and metadata. And they divide these segments into blocks of 4 kilobytes. So what it does is that NilFS will have metadata that will save the location of each of the blocks of each file. So it has a large index where you can find this information, and this index is potentially easy to store in cache or in other structures, because the metadata is super small. It's 128 bytes for each item, so it's easy to find the data block corresponding to a file.
You mean you don't require additional I/O because all the metadata is cached?
It's easy. Well, it's
you say it's easy. I don't know what that
it's
means.
It's easier than another file system. So the size of the metadata is smaller than for other file systems. So
more of it can be cached?
More of it can be cached. So it's easier for them to make these lookups. It requires less IOs. They don't make an extensive analysis of this, but they do it with this intention.
When you say easy, you mean efficient?
Yes.
Okay.
If more efficient, yes.
Yeah. Because easy... I mean, yeah. I'm just trying to understand what's in your mind.
Yeah, so they try to do this more efficiently by reducing the size of the metadata.
Okay.
So there's this one feature, which is that nilfs will never write into the middle of an ad segment. And what it means is that there's a set of segments that they still have data active, and they have a way to track down which one are these, and they keep an index that points to all these blocks that remain active. So basically, these are blocks that haven't been modified in some time, and they may be in a snapshot that is old, but they're still there. It hasn't been modified, so they keep it there. So what happens is that you may have segments, very old segments, that have just one or two blocks of data that are still active because they haven't been modified in a long time. And you might fill your whole device with snapshots. So they require, at some point, some garbage collection somehow, and just collect all these active blocks and create a new index and put this all together. Vasily, were you about to say something?
Yeah, so a couple of questions so far. You mentioned the index of the metadata.
Mm-hmm.
So do I understand correctly, this is the index, we're talking about in RAM index or on disk index or both?
They keep it in disk, but they cache it.
So they have like a completely separate structure, a completely separate index from segments to store the metadata, or is this the same index as you're talking in point 4 on the slide? Like each segment has some indexes, right?
Yeah, exactly. So
indexes you're talking about?
Yeah, some indices, but this index, this particular index is called the super root index. And it's the super block will have a pointer to this super root inode. And basically, this inode will point to all files in the system. So the way they do it is that every once in a while they update the super root, but they don't say when exactly. And they just say that every once in a while they do it. And I'm guessing that it has to do something like after garbage collection or every set period of time, but they don't really specify it. And I got this, I read two sources. One is the actual paper of the nilfs, and the other one is an article based on the nilfs design and some guy in the LFW webpage did an analysis and published an article, which is super interesting and was super insightful too.
Oh, great. Now, when they say everything is a file, does that mean even the data indexes are files, inodes are files,
yes.
Inode indexes are files,
yes.
Everything is a file?
Everything is a file. And it contains an inode that references the file.
And all of these are these files are indexed in the super block?
No, the super root indexes is like the root inode that will index everything else.
Okay, the super root inode contains the super root index.
Yes,
I mean it describes the super root index file.
Yes,
I'm guessing
exactly.
And that and a pointer to that super root inode is in the super block.
Yes. And there are several copies of this super root inode because of the different snapshots.
Mm-hmm.
But the super block will contain the latest one, the pointer to the latest one.
Okay.
So basically what happens is that if you want to make a recovery from a crash or something like that, you start from the address where the super root is, and from there on, all the snapshots are the most recent ones. All the valid snapshots are the most recent ones. So you just read those continuously, and you will get you read from the super root inode forward all the snapshots that are after that, and those are the most recent valid ones. So if we can
that
get
part
to,
is not super clear to me.
Okay, so I'm gonna go to the next slide and potentially I can make it easier to explain. So in the next slide is kind of like the structure of the segment. So this might be easier to understand. So in the the first part of the image, we have four segments that, that are there before cleaning. So if you want to, so there's a, each segment is composed of data, the inodes, and the indexes of each of them, and maybe a super root inode. But there is.
Can you have an inode for a in a different segment than the data block? So let's say you have a file, the inode goes into one segment and data blocks go into another segment. I guess it would be possible.
Yes, if the metadata hasn't been updated, then.
But the index block is indexing the blocks in that segment, or it's.
In that segment, just for that segment, yes. So the super root block will index everything. For everything, so that you, you can find stuff there, basically. And they do this with a B-tree, basically. The inodes are B-trees, are composed of B-trees.
The super root block, what does that mean?
The super, the inode.
The super root inode just tells you where the super root file is.
No. The super block have a pointer to the super root inode.
Yeah.
And this inode will index everything the file system.
How can it index everything in the file system? One inode cannot index everything in the file system.
So they do this by the inode is composed instead of a regular, instead of a traditional way, they use a B-tree to index the location of every.
See, that's the gap in my understanding at least. To me, it seems like the super root inode is metadata for the super root file. I mean, that's the way I understood it when you were talking about it earlier. And that file contains this, you know, pointers or describes everything in the file system.
Yeah.
But you said that the inode is the one that describes.
Well, okay, so the inode, remember that the inode is also a file, so. They refer as the super root inode, and they say there's also a file, so...
Oh, okay. Okay, so there's a little bit of terminology confusion here.
Yeah. So they refer to it, but then they say it's what they call an I-file.
Mm-hmm.
And it contains all the inodes and all the pointers to all the inodes, and then you can access from those inodes the data.
Okay. And what is this SS block?
So, okay, so there's an, so every segment is composed of all this data, the inodes, and all the recent changes on that segment, right? But you need some.
When you say recent data, inode, that those are all the only things you have. What are the recent changes you're talking about now?
So you can have like data recently added, recently written, or metadata recently. So you have.
So they are data and inode blocks.
Yes, and indexes as well.
I don't see it here.
Well, they don't put it. They don't put it there. But that's.
But the indexes are.
The indexes may be part of these segments as well.
Where is this index coming from? How is this index related to the inode and data blocks?
So the indexes. Well, from what I understood, the indices that belong to the segments just describe the data that is held in the
segment summary. Are you talking about segment summary?
So then? Yeah, it's like a segment summary. So that's the segment summary.
Okay. So it's the segment summary is the index.
Yeah, it's the indices for the inodes and the data.
Okay. So the segment summary keeps track of what
is on the segment.
In the segment. So that when you have to do, I guess, garbage collection of the segment, you can do it more efficiently.
Yeah. So they have a structures that will let you know which of these blocks are still active.
Yeah.
So you know what's there. You know if you have a clear segment or not.
Okay.
So for example, you have in this case you have a clear segment, and then you have four segments before cleaning. So the segment summary keeps track of which of these blocks are the ones that are still active, and then you can group them in a clean segment, and then erase all everything else.
Yeah.
And these segments can be 8 megabytes, mm-hmm. up to 8 megabytes, or the size that you set it up with, but they can also be partial writes. So you can have a segment that's smaller than 8 megabytes.
You mean it's not completely used?
It doesn't have to be, no.
But the segment size is 8 megabytes. It's just that you're using a part of it.
Yes, it's a partial...
Partially filled segment.
Yeah.
So it's just like, I mean, if you have a clean segment, you write into it, and you stop writing into it, you're not guaranteed to fill the segment. Is that what you mean?
Right, yes. And it's because they do continuous snapshots or checkpoints.
I see. Okay.
So sometimes there is not enough time or enough IOs to fill a whole segment. So they just, because these segments, all the data that is collected in these segments can be from different files.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all represented by the segment summary.
Okay.
Okay. Any questions, Vasily?
So far, I mean, I'm not sure I understand the index because I don't see it on slide 3 at this point. I understand this picture that you have right now well, I think. I understand what's data, what's the inode. But the index, I can see that in the next slide you will talk a little bit more about index. Maybe it will become more clear. Because, I mean, the good mental exercise trying to understand the file system is to understand if you can map a specific inode into a specific block number, right? So that's eventually what the on-disk file systems do, right? You have a number of the inode, and you don't have anything in RAM, right? You're just mounting the file system. How do you get from the number to the specific block ID where the data for this inode is, right? You would have to traverse some indexes, some maybe inode tables, indirect blocks, I mean, for some of the file systems. So right now, I'm still not clear if I can map from the inode number to the block, but maybe on the next slide I will understand it.
Okay. So the index file structure basically consists of it's a table basically.
Is the index file the same as the super root?
Depends on the super root inode is an index file, but it's the one that references to everything else. Well, there may be different index files.
There may be different index files.
Right, because there's also some that, like in the segment summary, there are some index files related to just the items that are in the segment.
Oh, they're using the same...
Yes, so they refer as the index file structure.
Okay.
So basically what they have is a group description. And in this group description, they know which this group description contains a bitmap, and basically it says what inodes are being used or not from the inodes that are stored in the file, and then you have each inode will be stored in blocks of 1 kilobyte, and you can, I mean, it could take several inodes, right? 10.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have up to 2/25 inodes in each of these group descriptions, but I mean, if you need more, you can extend the size of the file and have another group description. So basically, if you make a lookup with an inode ID, you just search for the bitmap, then since each inode has a constant size of 128 bytes, you can just look for it linearly. You can get the offset. I think that's how they do it. By the use of the structure that they describe. They first look for the usage bitmap to be if it's used or not, and then they get the actual inode information in the file that way. And then they talk about this problem in which they say, like, we contain several inodes in one block, in each of these blocks of this file. So every time, if you want to, for example, modify more than one inode in the same block, then you have to wait for sequentially to be done sequentially, because you can only modify one block at a time. The block once at a time. Maybe.
So Ricardo, on this slide, the index file structure, we're on slide 4, right?
Huh?
Yes.
We're on slide 4, right? So in this file, is it laid out sequentially on the disk, or this is just a logical representation in this, let's say, inode block with the number 32 on the slide? They actually can be scattered across the different parts of the disk.
No, it's not scattered on different parts of the disk, because they have the... So they update this file every once in a while. So what happens is that they write it sequentially on the disk, and then they point the super root in the super root.
And then they update the reference from the super root. That's
yeah.
Thing, right?
Yeah.
So if I understand correctly, when you just create a file system, there will be just one group descriptor. I guess it grows, the number of group descriptors kind of grows as file system grows, right?
Yes.
So in the first group descriptor, if my calculations are correct, it is about 140 something megabytes. So if you just, you know, each block is 4 kilobytes, and you say you have 2 to 25, and then you multiply it by 4 kilobytes, it's about 140 megabytes. And it means every single time when they, you know, kind of need to create that snapshot photo, say, or need a new reference from that super block to the new thing, we have to write 140 megabytes approximately. Is this the case?
Inodes are 128 bytes in size.
Yes. Inodes are 128 bytes in
right.
size, so it's 2 to the 20th.
I understand, but then if you multiply it by 32, that's exactly 4 kilobytes, which is the size of the block,
oh.
Right? So every block is 4 kilobytes, and then you have 2 to the 25 of these blocks, or 2 to the 25 inodes, I'm sorry.
So it's inodes.
Oh, okay, so just inodes, okay.
So you just...
I don't know why they broke it up into 32 inodes. Because I guess they wanted to show pages.
No, because the entire block size is 4 kilobytes.
The entire block size? What entire block size?
So remember that in the segment size is 8 megabytes and the block size is 4 kilobytes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So this whole thing.
Okay, now I understand. So I think the picture was a little bit misleading. It's 2 to 25, as it's 2 to 25 blocks containing inodes, but it's just 2 to 25 inodes. Which means the size of the group descriptor is actually much smaller, a few megabytes.
It's probably 8
megabytes,
I'm guessing, because they want to align the group descriptor size to the segment size.
Mm-hmm.
That would be my guess.
Right. So, but it means that every single time that they need to create like a new that new snapshot, they have to write these 4 megabytes on disk.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, but they don't do it every time. So they modify. So the one thing that they do is update these inodes. They do every write in place except for the updates of this file. So every once in a while, they group everything and they write it sequentially again. But
group everything meaning the metadata or the data?
They group all the data and the metadata and they update this file as well. But they don't do it on every snapshot or.
So when you say they group all the metadata and update metadata and data and then update this file, don't they write the data and metadata as well?
Yes, I mean because they want to get the space of the disk back. They want to clear the space.
Okay.
So they create the index file and then they start moving the data and writing in the index file all the new entries, updating the entries on the new
updating
index file.
Updating the entries of the index file structure.
Yeah.
Let's say you update like two files. So you write data for two files and you write metadata for two files. And
in
these
the new
two
segment.
Files, and these two files are, let's say, in two different group descriptors.
Okay. Well, Okay,
and then so what would happen? First, they would write the data and the metadata, and then they would update.
Yes.
Group descriptor. So mm-hmm. they copy the whole thing, or they update just one inode in place?
No, they write the inode
in
the,
place.
In place.
In the same group descriptor.
In the same segment.
In the same segment that contains the group descriptor for that inode. Because the inodes are all in group descriptors.
No, but this is like a reference to where the... is. It must... I mean, like the index file, it's just going to put a reference on where the inode is.
No, it says 2 to the 25 inodes are in here.
Hmm.
It doesn't say inode pointer.
Right. Okay, so they rewrite the... Because they say that they keep the inodes in the segment as well. So they are copying the... They're overwriting the inode in the index file as well.
That's a part that's not clear. If the inodes are sitting in some data segment somewhere, what are they doing here in this group descriptor? Or are there copies of these inodes in both places?
Well, they keep the copies in the segments because I think that if they want to recover the system, they do all the reads from the mm-hmm. the last big snapshot, which was when the new, you know, root inode was written until then.
So let's go back to the example of two files A and B being updated.
Okay.
You update the data, you update A's inode and B's inode.
Okay.
You write data and inodes for A and B in some data segment.
Okay.
Right?
Okay.
So for okay. And then you also have A and B's inode in the group descriptor segments. Alright, so you would have to at some point update. Maybe it doesn't happen right away, but it needs to happen.
Exactly. And then they modify it.
They modify it in place, or what is
so they write everything in, they write every update in place, and then they have to modify. I mean, what I understood from the article and the paper is that they have to go back to this file and modify it as well. So one of the few modifications that they don't do in place, the writes that they don't do in place in the NILFS, is modifying this file.
Oh, okay, so they collect all the inode updates.
Yes.
For each group descriptor, and then they apply all of those.
So when
at
you,
once, exactly. Because you need to make a copy, and so instead of making a copy for each inode update, they collect a bunch of inode updates and make a single copy and update all those inodes. Is that what your understanding is?
So my exact understanding is that when they have an update, they write it in place first in the segment. And then they grab all the inode updates that they did there and they modify the file.
Modify this index file.
Yes.
Index file.
Yes.
But that can happen periodically. It doesn't happen. It doesn't need to happen right away.
I don't think that they don't state that they do it right away.
Which is what they mean by snapshotting, I guess.
Yes. So they keep...
This index file represent some snapshot in time, and then the next snapshot includes a whole bunch of updates. So I don't know then what does continuous snapshot mean.
So they write... Each segment is like a snapshot of what's... Of the last modifications. So they keep this 8 megabytes of new data.
Yeah,
it's like a short term snapshot, and you can recover
the recover system
state until that snapshot until the last valid snapshot. So what they say is that the data that you might lose is small compared to.
Oh, you can lose data.
I mean, if a snapshot fails, the last snapshot is right. You can lose the last snapshot while you're writing it.
If I do an fsync, I still lose the data?
I mean, if you're writing the last snapshot and it fails, like the system fails, then you lose the last. So you do an fsync and you're syncing the last 8 megabytes, or then if the system fails at that moment, then you lose that data, right? And that snapshot is going to be invalid.
If your fsync completes, does that mean I get a new snapshot, which is up to date with the fsync?
Yes, exactly.
I see. Okay, so then it's fine. Yes. So you don't have any data loss.
No.
Because, I mean, file systems don't guarantee that writes are persistent unless you do a sync operation.
Well, there's... Yeah.
So you need to understand what they mean by data loss. I don't understand it.
Well, yeah, what I do understand is that the continuous snapshot is the way that they make sure that they don't lose data. But,
well, I think I provide a little bit of insight on that. So what happens is that they periodically write that super block in the log, right, in which everything is referenced. So every super block which is in the log represents a specific state of the file system. So you can easily, roll back to a few states of the system, and the state is basically between the fsync. But it's not only that the fsync is called exclusively, but also when the time comes and periodically they actually say, okay, it's time to make a checkpoint, so to say. So they do all this continuous checkpointing, and the user, and they do not delete previous data and previous bitmaps, they're still in the log. So there is, they do not reuse that space for new allocations. So as a result, you can see the state of the previous system really far back, unless you configure an LFS to purge old snapshots. Does that make sense?
So I'm just a little concerned about the use of the term continuous. They don't, it's more like sporadic the way I see it.
Well, yes, that is true. Actually, that reference that Ricardo sent on the ILWN, they say that continuous snapshot is not a really good name.
So
It basically says it takes a snapshot every few seconds. That's the real key.
Okay, then it makes sense to me. Okay, thank you.
They call it short-term snapshot, also called checkpoints. To be more fancy, continuous.
Okay.
So one more thing I was quickly looking through. So, Ricardo, you're saying that they're doing updates in place, but I really think they're not doing in-place updates in the LFS. I think that, pure LFS, log structured file system, the only thing that they basically update in place is that super block, so to say, in which they're referencing the latest checkpoint, the latest super block in the log.
Right. Yeah, I don't... Sorry, I think we figured out that it's not an update in place. It's just that whenever you update this index file structure, you update, you collect a bunch of inode updates and you do it in a different copy.
Yes.
You started by saying update in place, but in the end, what you described was not update
in
place.
The update in place is just the index file structure.
No, that's what I'm saying. I mean, even the index file structure is not update in place.
Yeah. Well, they write in the new segment all the copy of the new changes that were done.
Update in place.
This file structure is updated in place later at some point, because this file structure is how they look for the
file is logically updated in place, but not physically. You mean logically updated in place?
No, but the index file structure is somewhere else. It's not where the new segment is, right? So you write this, the new data, and you need to invalidate the old data,
okay,
right? This index file structure is pointing to the old data.
Yeah.
So you need to update this index file structure.
So the index file structure you're saying it's updated in place?
Yes, it's the only thing that is updated in place.
What about the super block?
Well, and the super block, yes. Of course, when you change the... Yes.
They so you're say saying the super both. Block and the index file...
Yes.
Index file are updated in place?
Yes.
Okay, so basically, I guess I was wrong. That's not... I thought that Ricardo described a process where the index file would be updated out of place, but no. you're saying that's not the case.
I'm still standing on my point where even the index file is updated out of place in terms of terminology. I don't think it's updated in place. And the reason I can, so if you go to the LWN article, so I'll just read a quick thing from here.
Mm-hmm.
It says, it compares F2FS to NeoFS, and it says, while F2FS is a hybrid block-structured file system that uses update-in-place in a number of cases, NeoFS is a pure LFS, pure block-structured file system. With the exception of the super block, everything is written in one continuous block. So, and it continues always. But basically it says that in NeoFS, only super block is updated in place, and everything else is written into the log. It's never overwritten. It's always just keep going and written to the new places.
Right. But then they talk, yeah, but the part of the super block is this pointer to the index file structure, right?
All
so
right,
you're saying
right.
The
what it means, you can relocate the index file structure and just update the pointer in the super block. So that's your right. So super block is updated in place, and the pointer is updated to the new location of the index file.
Okay, so...
Make sense?
Okay, so every time that you update data, or, yeah... So, okay, so let's assume that you update a data block. How would you know if you don't modify the index file structure? Because they don't...
Well,
they don't...
you would have to modify the index file structure, but you can create a copy of the index file structure.
Every time? Like, for the whole metadata?
That's what a log-structured file system does. And a log-structured file system only writes in a log. It doesn't update in place. And then you write it elsewhere, and then you change the pointer in the super block to say, well, the index file is not here anymore. It's in this new place that I wrote it.
But that's not clear to me, because for what I understood, they don't do this on every update. They do this...
Right, so they don't do it on every user update. So it's like, let's say you have written something to the file, then it's not going to be an I/O or something. They're going to keep a segment in memory for a while, which represents the copy of the old version of, let's say, file index. And then after some time, when this 8 megabyte segment is full, or let's say it's not full, but the time has come to write it to the disk, they're going to write it in the new location. But they're not going to do it with every single user write. They're going to buffer it for a while in RAM. And this is what you were saying, that you can lose a little bit of the data. If you lose the power in the middle, you will lose, but not all of the data, but just the data that was buffered in RAM after the previous snapshot was written, after the previous index file structure was written, and the super block was updated correspondingly.
Okay. I'm still...
Why don't you go back and read
again
on the LBN, that the LWN article that Vasily is reading from, and then confirm your own understanding.
Okay.
We can have a discussion if you now on what you found. Okay.
Yeah.
So should we go on to the next slide? Okay.
So yeah, that was talking about the inode structure, and they say that they have a B-tree, and they say that this structure is not the typical use case for the B-tree, in the sense that it's supposed to describe continuous range of blocks. So basically what happens is that an inode have it can contain 7 addresses, but since files can be larger than that, so they use a B-tree structure that have different, you know, levels of indirection, right? And they say that, so B-trees will usually contain ranges of addresses instead of individual descriptions, but they say that in this case they're using the size of these nodes is larger because they use they describe each of the blocks individually instead of ranges of blocks.
So sorry, Gerda, quick question: what is exactly, we have inode of 128 bytes. What exactly is stored there?
I haven't found. I would need to look into the documentation of the kernel to see that, but
mm-hmm.
they don't
right.
describe it in the article or the paper, I think.
Right.
Yeah. I think it is important to understand what's there, because, you know, on this slide you are showing that, I think what you are showing is that they're storing the roots of the B-trees, and somehow this allows them to map logical addresses within file to the physical addresses on the disk, to the data blocks. I think this is what you're trying to describe, but it would be really nice to kind of confirm it, because I'm not sure really.
Okay.
And what does DAT lookup mean? What is DAT?
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, from what I understood, the basically it's like they get the
table, or is it a table of some kind?
I'm not sure. I don't want to just say
okay.
anything.
Okay, so you still need to understand those figures.
Yeah.
Okay. And should we talk about this? Or?
That's also some extra files that you know, they talk about it.
So we're looking at page 6 now, and we shouldn't be looking at this either, right?
I mean, it's just some extra information that I just wanted to keep there.
Okay.
But,
all right, so should we stop this presentation now?
Yeah.
All right. Okay, so do we have any explanation yet for the performance that we see with NILFS?
No.
Not yet.
No, I have to look into the...
I mean, this description helps to introduce us to NILFS, but doesn't help us to explain the problem, the performance issue that we are seeing.
No, because I got to analyze, you know, different aspects of the results in the experiments, like CPU performance and what's happening on disk, and I mean, to see what are possible contentions and then find explanations. But if I don't understand the file system, I cannot make any conclusions out of the data either.
Of course. And when you do the file system evaluation, you need to actually format the disk and create the file system, and only then can you run the experiments, correct?
Yeah.
Okay. And this is with the RAM disk.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Okay, so what are the next steps then?
Mm-hmm.
So the next steps will be to first analyze the data from the two points and see if it's the same, it has the same problems as Vasily's result have. See if they're the same performance. Then analyze a little bit more deeply all the CPU stats and the disk stats and all that information, and see if I can get something from that. And I would also like to read these two articles more carefully to understand better, because I read everything and I. But, I mean, clearly there's still something. I mean, because there's not, like, a thorough explanation and a long paper about it. It's just a short paper and a short article on the so far. And there's not much other documentation that they reference to. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, but I think, you know, what helps in this analysis, what might help you refer to this analysis, so the workload where we see these, I think, is a web server workload, right, where most of them are reads, right?
Mm-hmm.
So as a result, it's very interesting. If you see this is a log structured file system that basically do not change if you do have only reads. You just, you know, you get the data from whatever it is, following the pointers, part of this pointer, some metadata already in RAM, part of it is not. So it's kind of a very simple situation, and still though, we see this very weird behavior. So, you know, you might
Yeah, certainly a very surprising behavior in NIL-FS that the latency of the device doesn't matter at all, which is completely unexpected.
Yeah, I mean, it's not what they show in the experiments that they in the paper, but but I'm not sure also about the experiments in the paper because they show experiments without garbage collection. It's not like a long-term experiment; it's just a short experiment. Read intensive, write intensive, but they make sure that they don't make any garbage collection. So I don't know how fast NIL-FS is with respect to other file systems. Although they have some papers that.
So do you know the garbage collection? It happens automatically, or does the user need to trigger it, or what?
No, I mean from my understanding is that it happens automatically when they're running out of space.
Okay, all right. So I don't think we run out of space in this experiment, right? So it means that it should not happen at all. And it would be nice to just reconfirm if there are any mount or config parameters or maybe utilities that come with NIL-FS that allow you. You know, because you can configure how many snapshots you keep, so there are some configuration parameters or maybe some tools that allow you to, you know, adjust, impact the behavior of garbage collection and checkpointing. So maybe if you look into that to make sure that this is not happening during our workload. Let's disable the garbage collection and we run the experiment. Do we see similar results with different ones?
Okay. Okay, so I'll try to modify different parameters and see if it changes the outcome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it would be nice so after you reconfirm the results, just for 2 points, the system already collects the disk stuff. So just to look, what was the amount of, you know, data written, what was the average latencies, what was the I/O sizes, are they remain the same for 2 points or different? That already might give enough clues to build some theory.
Okay.
All right, I think that's interesting. I didn't know how NIL-FS works before, so now at least some understanding I think we have. That's great. And if you can look a little bit more into that in parallel with, you know, running the experiments and trying to get some results, that would be great, actually.
Yes, I'll try to start working on that as soon as possible. I want to generate the data as I, you know, study this more because I still have some gaps in the knowledge because it's not very extensive. So, you know.
Okay, so sounds good. So there are not much updates on my side this time. I was kind of busy with some other project that I needed to finish, but I'm free again, so I'm going to start writing the text and also getting extra points for the experiments where we have a high standard deviation. I'll share these results next time because I think we're even a little bit late already.
Yeah. And Vasily, you will be at FAST, right? You said you're going to be there?
Yes, we're going to meet, remember, on that first... on the break after your session.
Yes. Okay, sounds good.
Yeah, but it's the week after the next week. We're still meeting next Friday, right?
Yes, we will meet next Friday and... and the week after that is when we will be away at FAST.
Right, yes. Well, okay. I think we probably will skip it because everybody will be kind of traveling. And are you going to that Linux FAST summit after FAST?
We found out that we are going, yes.
Okay, cool. So, yeah, I'm also going there, so I guess we'll go with each other there as well.
Yes. Sounds good.
All right, great.
Okay.
Then talk to you next week.
Talk to you next week.
Have a good
weekend.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.